Good afternoon. So, last time, we started by finishing up talking about pattern matching by looking at how we can apply that to matching machine code, which is typically what we're going to do if we're dealing with malicious programs that are compiled, and we want to identify them. And we saw that this pattern matching has the flexibility of finding things like viruses and other sort of malware, which doesn't always look the same. We can't just like say it's this exact file. If we see that, it's what it is. We need to look for some variations. Then we talked about making this sort of matching more efficient. Regular expression type matching, because we can make a state machine that sort of works character by character, it's pretty fast, but it's not actually great. We still need to read all files, and we still need to go character by character. Can we do better? And the answer is, well, sometimes yes. So we can, for example, try to find sort of anchor strings and like match those by hashing little segments of our executables or other files we're matching against a table of those, which keeps us from having to store potentially like millions of patterns in memory when we're scanning over files. And we can also avoid scanning parts of the file that are less likely to have malicious code, or at least the signature malicious code we're looking for. And we can work backwards and figure out that this head and tail strategy, was popular, might be a reason why malware would have hidden their entry points by not just going to the end or beginning of an executable file. So then we looked at some non-pattern matching based techniques. So you mentioned this idea of behavior-based detection, that rather than trying to identify malicious programs by looking for the code, we could just look at what they do. So, example, most programs shouldn't be writing to other executables. And maybe we can look at the pattern of those sorts of writes and reads and say, oh, this is probably some piece of malicious code. And we learn that, well, typically there's mechanisms to hook OS calls, often deliberately put there by the operating system manufacturer. And if there's not one, we can kind of edit the OS ourselves to add those, or edit the libraries that programs use to add those, to add our own code that runs in between and take some action based on apparently suspicious behavior. We also mentioned there are other things we can look for which are kind of generic, which don't involve having a signature for a very specific piece of malicious code. Like we can just say, well, a lot of malware is going to mess up the executable file in some ways that compilers and linkers probably would never do. We can just look for that and force our malware authors to produce cleaner executables. Or we can look for things like looking up library functions by name, obvious signs of that, like the names of the library functions in places that the dynamic linker wouldn't use. And there's other sorts of behavior we can look at. And one temptation when doing this sort of behavior-based detection is you might say, oh, we have all these sorts of features that tell us if a program's malicious. Let's just put them into a big machine learning algorithm and get out a malware detector. And you can certainly do this. And I don't think it's a good idea unless you are taking some extra steps, because we have this adversarial context that if you do that and start deploying it, well, malware authors are going to start doing things that try to defeat that. And for sort of standard machine learning techniques, that aren't trying to be aware of this adversarial situation, that aren't aware that someone's trying to attack it, the malware author can do things like add extra behavior that is normal that you might overemphasize in your machine learning model because you didn't see enough examples of malware doing it. Or they might poison your training data because they can just give you lots of malware samples that maybe aren't the ones they actually care about. That's just a cautionary tale, since everyone loves machine learning, but doesn't actually work in the sort of standard way in this malware detection context. Then we looked at sort of not the defender's perspective, which was all this stuff, but an attacker's perspective, you know, trying to defeat some of these mechanisms, particularly focusing on this sort of pattern matching idea. That pattern matching worked because we had sort of nice, easy to follow machine code where we could easily figure out what the malicious part is and easily write a pattern for it. And we learned about sort of, well, ways of making that sort of analysis harder. And first we talked about just ways of making it harder for someone who writes patterns by hand to figure out, oh, what is this malware doing? So we mentioned that one thing we might want to mess up is cataloging what each function does. So in the RE assignment, you like wrote down what a function did, most of you successfully. And, you know, that's a very reasonable way to start analyzing a big piece of software you get in binary format. It's like, well, there's a bunch of functions. The functions are probably very nice and modular. And well, we learned that, well, we can just do these sort of transformations where we undo that by splitting and merging functions from our original clean code. And another thing you might look at before you figure out what the details of what a function does is you might say, oh, there's a loop here. There's like an if statement here. You can relatively easily identify those patterns. So we might do some transformation where we kind of try to obscure that and make that require a lot more work to analyze. And there's a whole lot of transformations you can imagine, which usually have this sort of goal where we say, here's something that would be convenient for analyzing, you know, this piece of software, you know, looking at how data goes or how it figures out what instructions to run. Let's try to disrupt that analysis by transforming the software. We learned that there are a bunch of those. Then we switch to, well, thinking back about signatures. And these techniques are good for preventing someone from quickly figuring out what some machine code does, but for making a signature for malware, that's not actually our goal. Our goal is just to find something unique that we're going to find in any version of it. And most commonly, like, we have strings and things like that it uses. So we mentioned, oh, well, we can hide those. So we can encrypt them. I have encrypt in these skill quotes because it's, well, it might use an encryption algorithm, but it's not encryption in the classical sense of like sending secret messages, because the key is not a secret. The instructions for decryption are actually right there in a machine readable format. And we'll talk about the implications of that later today. But this sort of technique of hiding the strings with some encryption, or even hashing them if you're only like comparing, sort of as a way of evading signatures where you might look for, you know, strings, like, you know, if your program sends emails with certain text, you can look for that text. This is a way of preventing those simple patterns. And we extended that, and what is going to be our first topic today, of, well, we can encrypt data like this. What about obscuring code like this? And we'll look at the implications of that as our first topic today. But first, any questions about these things we covered last time? I have one question about question 3 on the quiz. And if you could be more specific, that would be great.
I just would want to ask about specifically why one of the patterns was correct for the pattern matching portion for B specifically, like why B was true, if you're looking at it right now. Because the thing that confused me was, I thought for the question we'd inserted a bunch of knobs between the XOR and the decrement instruction, but in...
you are correct. The key is wrong, and I just made a mistake in writing that. I will correct the key.
Okay, no worries. Thank you.
I'll just do that right now. And why do I have people... Why is my phone not silent? Okay, so yeah, but the key is wrong. I will just correct that because I tried to write that as a right answer and put something in the wrong space. And go to here. Any other questions? B is wrong because we're inserting the nops in between, in the middle of an instruction instead of after the XOR instruction. And someone asking about 1C. So 1C is asking, you know, what would happen if we set a global offset table entry to point to something? So future calls we'll call foo instead, and that's true for all the calls. So remember when we have a global offset table, so we have this global offset table, which has an entry, which we expect to point to our standard library function. And remember, there's this code here, which reads this entry and calls it. And what we're saying in option 1C is that our timeline is that our program was running, we had some calls in the past that used this and actually ended up calling the normal standard library function. And then the global offset table entry was overwritten, and now we have some later calls to the same standard library function. Those later calls are going to use the same stub and the same table entry, but now we've overwritten it, so it points to some other location. And these future calls are going to use that other location. And the question is, doesn't it say before it was overwritten? So the phrasing is future calls to the library function will call foo instead, and the library function was called before the global offset table was overwritten. So it was called before, but we're asking about future calls. I am sorry I did not figure out a way of phrasing that clearer when I was writing the quiz. So a question. Before this table entry here was filled in to contain... it just contained a pointer to linker stub. So if lazy linking was used, then before our program started running, way up here, the initial value of this table entry was pointed to the linker, and the first call would use that, and then it would be corrected to the standard library. And a question in the quiz, why is option B and 3 correct? That was a typo on the quiz, right, which I mentioned earlier. We'll correct that now. There. Okay, other questions? So, picking up, like I said, we're going to work on this encrypted data idea, but applying to code. So sort of our basic idea is that we'll have some machine code that's stored in this encoded, quote-unquote, encrypted form, and our virus, what we'll do, or our other malware, which might not be a virus, will use some key to decrypt this and then jump to that code. This is like not actually C code we could write, but sort of pseudo what it would look like. And this decrypt function will do something useful. useful for decoding this. So as an example, Cascade was a virus which used this strategy. So basically what it would do is it would sort of load a pointer to its encrypted code and have this loop which just runs a few XORs, and then it would, after it finishes running that loop, be running the encrypted code. So there's a question, isn't this code here, isn't this a good signature? And that's indeed something we can think about. So what are ways we can deal with this? I'm thinking, like, so I have a whole bunch of ideas for finding, decryptors like this and dealing with encrypted malware. So let's say, which is most least practical for, like, if we need to match this. Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on like what seems to be the least practical strategy, and that is this. That is the sort of brute force. That is indeed a thing that we probably don't have the luxury of doing, though in this case, the key is actually very small, so maybe we could, but that is a lot of work compared to our other options, it seems like. But this might be possible because it turns out the key here is the effective key is... so the effective key is, about 1 byte. So there's basically 256 different ways the decryption can work, which is not actually that bad. Or is it about 1 byte? Or no. Oh, sorry. It's about 2 bytes. So that might be doable, but yeah, it's not great. So this seems hard, and I agree that that's probably the least practical strategy. So as far as practical strategies, so someone sort of mentioned as a question, we can match the decryptor. And this is indeed something we'll often do. Sort of the only risk with this is, does someone use the same decryptor for something else? So in the case of Cascade, I don't think this was an issue. There's some malware out there which uses this strategy where the same code might also be shared by some commercial software, which would make this inconvenient. But as long as that's not the case, this is, great. We can use our existing stuff to match it. It is one of the most probably practical and widely used strategies. So then for other strategies that people thought were good, I think we have a lot of people liking, I think, either E or A. So A is that, well, we don't have to scan executable files. We can scan the memory of executables after they start running. And this sort of idea is going to be sort of the key generic way of dealing with this problem, is that, we can run the code. We can look at what happens after the code runs. We aren't stuck dealing with the executable versions in many real scenarios. Now, this doesn't work so easily if we're thinking about like scanning emails, but as far as sort of active anti-malware software, this might be pretty practical. And same thing, if we have active anti-malware software, we could just look at the sequence of file operations that are done and have that sort of that as our signature instead, and that is pretty robust to other sorts of changes. So the only option we haven't talked about is this B, which I think you could do. I think probably this doesn't end up working out just because there's going to be other reasons for executables to have random looking data, and also because this is not a good encryption algorithm. So it's likely that the results do not actually look random to a typical statistical test. And it not being a good encryption algorithm is actually very typical, because remember we said it was sort of scare quotes encryption, not real encryption. So questions about my assessments of these options? Okay, so we learned that the decryptor code probably is a signature. So if you assume that no one's using that for legitimate software, it seems like that's a problem for the goal we had earlier of evading that signature-based detection, that we have this great signature, and we need to deal with that. There's a question before I move on. Like, couldn't we also look to bytes that don't map to valid instructions being placed in sections loaded as executable? So that is a valid strategy, but there's probably some easy workarounds. For example, there could be code here that this encrypted code could be copied from some data segment instead, or be allocated at runtime, copied from some data segment. And also, it's probably annoying in x86 to look for bytes that don't map to valid instructions because the instructions are variable length. But that might be more practical on some other architectures. But we're going to look at a strategy where we're just going to make the signatures. We're going to look at this idea of, well, we have these, the decryptor code is the signature. We're going to look at how this is some idea that we could do that is going to break. And the big idea is that we want the decryptor code to have multiple variants. So we can do what Zor calls an oligomorphic virus does, which is that, well, we'll have our encrypted code, and when we're replicating ourselves, we'll have a generator for a new decryptor. And we'll have a sort of template. And our template will have like some choices. We'll like choose a random key. We'll choose some insert some random knobs. We might have some other sort of choices where we can generate a whole family of different decryptors. And therefore, not one signature will work. So here I have it in the encrypted code, which is how we can make this work with something self-replicating. If we just wanted to like produce one-off programs, we We obviously don't even need to have it in there. But this sort of shows why what our big advantage of doing this encryption thing is that, well, now we have an easy way of hiding this code. And making this code not a signature itself. And this code generates our decryptor code. And now it's not an easy fixed string signature anymore. So you can do all sorts of things to vary the code. So here I just showed, oh, we're just going to write a variable round of nops, like our sort of our quiz question. But we could do better than that. We can like just switch between sort of related instructions. Like we can switch on an add for a subtract. We can swap the registers. We can add instructions that manipulate unused registers. There's a whole bunch of options we have in our sort of template for generating decryptors, you know, that can make sure there's lots of variations and make it more difficult to write a signature. So Zor gives the example of one of the early Windows 95 viruses, Memorial, where you might, these might be two versions of the decryptor that it generates. You can see it does things like reorder between the, some of these instructions that can be reordered. It inserts nops, but, you know, in variable places, and unrelated, some instructions that might not be, well, it has, sorry, it has two, like, different ways of doing the loop. And this is all with the idea that it should be harder to write a signature for this. And what ends up happening is that the people who at the antivirus company, they figure out what the actual pattern is that encompasses all these variations, and they write sort of one of those regular expression-based signatures. But you've sort of made their job a lot more difficult, and also you've made the signature matching slower.
To clarify, so the code on the left, the symbol on the left, is that the regular, and then the right one is the infected version?
So question is, this infected, regular infected? No, these are two different infected versions. So this is like version one, version two. And what happens is that, you know, this decryptor is generated by some generation code, which like makes some random choices. And so some of the choices it makes are it randomly chooses the order of these two move instructions. And it randomly chooses whether to use the loop instruction or a J and Z. Does that make sense? So the question is, why is the random code in the decryptor? I'm maybe not explaining something. So the code I'm showing you on this slide is this code here. But there's some code which generates it, which might have a structure like this. So that's going to be in the encrypted code. That's part of the copying code. So this is our decrypting code. And this is generated by some code I'm not showing you. That's presumably part of the infect a new file code. So here we're seeing like basically a small number of choices. And Zor cataloged it as, well, there's 96 different decryptors it could generate. So they had like a bunch of if statements or like loops. And, you know, they had this template which made 96 different versions. And, you know, that's pretty annoying, but you can deal with that by writing a pattern. And actually, you can probably include 96 different patterns if you really needed to. But this technique got sort of more advanced, and Zor called this sort of next level up as far as generating variations something that was polymorphic. So this is an example of a virus called 1260, and it had a way of generating way, way more variations. We'll talk about sort of the general idea, sort of on the structure it used for that, which sort of ended up being very common in the more sophisticated examples of this technique, and is also very general. So here is sort of what its what sort of two versions of its decryptor might look like. Some excerpts from Zor's book. And in here, there's this whole bunch of instructions which turn out to not do anything. And you might say, wait a moment. This does something. It increments a value. This is a subtract. These seem all like useful instructions. Why am I saying they're do-nothing instructions? And the trick that 1260 that used is, well, its actual decryptor is basically just this stuff here. And they just inserted a whole bunch of random instructions that didn't use these registers, these four registers they were using. And because they weren't using any of those other registers, they could generate all these sort of extra instructions that use those other registers. So you can still write a pattern for this, but it gets really annoying. And it kind of seems like the virus author really has an edge on you when they can do this sort of thing, especially because, you know, since they were careful not to use the DX, BX, and CX registers, they have this huge variety of extra instructions they can easily add just by knowing a little bit about machine coding. Okay. So question, how do viruses get named? I don't know the details. I assume the person who discovers them chooses something is mostly how it works. Okay. So questions about this example here. So the idea that we have these instructions that actually do something, but we can insert these whole bunch of extra instructions. And sort of the structure that 1260 had that sort of was the core of this is that had what Zor calls a mutation engine. So basically, rather than writing this sort of template code here, most of the work of generating a new decryptor was done with this sort of generic code, which says, okay, we'll take some machine code and we'll sort of randomize it. So we have this sort of very generic way. Oh, we can always insert knobs between every instruction, and we might have in more sophisticated variants, which we might look at a little later when we talk about sort of the endpoint of this technique, where we like choose variants of these other instructions. So in this case, it looks like 1260 mostly doesn't do that. It does choose a random key for the decryption, but other than that, the instructions look fixed. But we could also apply the technique we saw earlier of like realizing, oh, this loop and this are equivalent, and we can use both of them. So the question is, this is intended to hide the signature of the decryptor and not the virus. So this hides the signature of the decryptor, and the hope is that the encryption, even though it's sort of scare quotes encryption, is good enough to hide the signature of the virus, because there's so many ways that the encrypted virus could look in the executable. The encrypted part of the virus, I should say, could look in the executable. Other questions? Question, isn't there a high false positive rate with common encryption algorithms? So your question is, if we are matching for the decryption, like, aren't we going to detect code like our browser, which we know implements, say, AES? And the answer is that we're not looking for the actual, you know, the encryption algorithm in the sense of the method we're using to obscure the code. Like, in all the cases we've seen here, it's this bunch of XORs. What we're looking at for, really, is going to be this sort of setup code here, and also the code afterwards, perhaps, that it, jumps to that, that's going to be more unique. And indeed, you know, it would make sense that if you were writing one of these today, you might use a normal encryption or decryption algorithm because you could, like, find one in a library and it wouldn't be suspicious to be in your executable. But you still have that extra code that sets that up and that jumps to the code there, and that would be what we'd be trying to match against. So a common name for this strategy of having us decode code that exists in our program and run it at runtime is that we call such programs packers. And these exist for non-malware reasons. So you might say, why would you do this? So one reason is people who imagine it protects their quote-unquote intellectual property because they think somehow it's going to keep people from copying their software, which maybe isn't as true as they think it is. But like, there's also very, you know, good reasons, like compression, right? If you want to have an executable be smaller, this is one way of doing it, is that you compress the code, decode it at runtime, uncompressing it in the process, and it looks very much the same. And because this exists for non-malware reasons, and for good non-malware reasons, anti-malware software kind of needs to deal with this in a way other than just detecting that we have this sort of decryption thing. So the most common way of dealing with it is you run it. You might say, well, that how do we do that if the user doesn't start it? Well, you can like run it in a virtual machine or an emulator or a debugger. And this is a real thing that a lot of antivirus software does in at least some limited circumstances. And this is also the sort of thing we would do if we were analyzing some piece of malware that used this technique, is that we'd run it in a debugger or an emulator to figure out its decrypted code. We don't need to like figure out what the encryption algorithm is because it does it. We just execute it and it will decrypt itself. And we can even automate this. So we can like say, okay, we'll run it in an emulator until it jumps to data it wrote. And you can, for example, find an implementation which basically does that. It runs it until, you know, it does gets to a certain jump or something similar like that. And once it's there, you can just scan the memory for the decrypted machine code, or you can take a more direct technique of, if you're in an emulator, you can configure your emulator to give you a full trace of the instructions it runs. So this technique, you know, it's very general. It's not great because obviously things are going to run slower in an emulator or a VM or a debugger. There's going to be other issues when malware is aware we're doing this that we'll talk about later, that malware can try to do things knowing that we're going to try to run it in a VM or an emulator or a debugger. This is sort of the generic way of dealing with all these encryption stuff. And when we use this technique, well, it doesn't matter sort of how cleverly your encryption is hidden if what you end up with afterwards is going to be easy to match. And notice that, you know, so that means we didn't need to do sort of clever things to understand the encryption algorithm. Yeah, so it's nice and generic. I'd like to go over, like, so mention that we can, like, scan for the decrypted machine code. So an obvious sort of, you know, defense you might try is like, let's decrypt it in multiple chunks. Multiple chunks, multiple layers. Like you might say, let's decrypt code which has more encrypted code in it. Which is why I mentioned that, well, you know, yes, you can do this stuff and some malware might, but we can kind of defeat all of this by just like looking at what instructions actually run. Because you're going to get some sort of trace like this, you might say it's going to be huge, but we can easily just duplicate it. We can say, oh, this is a loop. I'm only going to keep one copy of this. And if we like deduplicate this, sort it by address, we probably can relatively easily read out the actual assembly code from what actually gets executed. And we can even deal with things like self-modifying code, where we'll say, oh, there's two different values at a particular address. Okay, that's what happened. Some questions about this idea of working from an instruction trace?
You go back to your other slide with just the multiple, and like I think the previous slide, like you had a comment about the defense. So like, in terms of like, what is?
Okay. So something someone might try to do is say, oh, you're gonna just scan the memory at some point. So why don't I just not decrypt the whole thing at once? Like that's a logical thing to do about that.
Split out sections of
encryption. Yeah, that's a thing that people might do. And, you know, first of all, even if we're doing it by hand, it's just a few extra steps, but we can kind of automate our way. Even if you're doing that, we can still have an automatic solution that kind of solves the problem from this trace of instructions. Sorry.
You said they have to have multiple keys as well, right? For these different multiple...
But that's not what I meant to write here. So this is multiple layers. So you might have, a decryptor that decrypts another decryptor. Like that's something people might try, but it turns out that doesn't actually give you very much extra because there's these relatively generic techniques for defeating the decryptors. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So we have ways of defeating these packers. And I note that in practice, we also have the benefit that most programs don't jump to code they wrote. And in modern OSs, you kind of have to make memory executable and writable at the same time very explicitly. That's typically not something that's supported. And this is not because they care about preventing this packer strategy or deterring malware. It's actually to prevent exploits they'll talk about later in the course. So it's probably fairly easy to also detect someone's writing code and then look further to see if you can find sort of bad signatures. So let's we talked about sort of this generic detection idea. So what are ways in which, so a thing we might say is, okay, we want to scan an executable for malicious code. So let's run it in a virtual machine and wait till it jumps to code it wrote out. Virtual machine / emulator. And then match patterns against the code it's about to run. So which of these ideas seems like it's going to cause the most work if we want to adapt this idea for our malware scanner, to deal with this malware that uses this technique? So we're applying this idea. We're going to run it in an emulator to scan emailed executables and try to do this pattern matching. So what seems like it's going to cause the least or most annoyance for us, because these are things which, might, mess up our detection. Scenario is, in say an emailed executable, we want to see if it's okay or not. Give another 15 seconds or so. Okay, so our assessment of things of the most problematic basically is that D seems real problematic, right? Because our virtual machine or emulators, especially with all this monitoring to figure out when this happens, seems like it's going to be a bunch slower, and we want to hide that from the executable, and it's not clear how you do that. So that this is indeed a big issue. And this is sort of a preview that there's this anti-virtualization techniques that some malware tries to use, where it tries to break, not work in a virtual machine or an emulator, precisely to defeat techniques like this. Sort of our second most problematic idea was B, right? That, well, you know, if we're automating this, if we want to like do this as part of an email scanner, it's going to be hard to like actually give inputs to the program. And that would be a good way of making it harder for us to detect the malicious code if it doesn't actually get ready to run. So your question, so there's a question, hey, couldn't we work around D by giving fake times? Yes, that would be a thing we try to do. So the question is that the only way the malicious software can try to guess what time it is? Guess, you know, or guess how fast things are. And the answer might be yes, in which case we're good. And if the answer is no, we have a, might have more problems. So next most problematic, people say, are either sort of an E or A seem problematic. So I'd say E is most problematic because of this statement here. We need to change that. But we could work fix that relatively easily. But it is a problem with our first technique for E. For A, it's not necessarily a problem, assuming we don't write to jump to code that was written out and not loaded from the executable until exit, assuming we run it that long. If we don't, we have a problem. And I would say allocating random addresses is not an issue because we're using this detection technique here, we don't actually care what addresses are being used. There's nothing to work around here. So, you know, not a problem. Because the way we're going to figure out whether it's code we're interested in is if it was written by the program, not what address it's at. Okay, so questions about my assessment of each of these? Okay, so with some of these, we've previewed some mechanisms you might use to defeat this sort of scanning technique, but there's also one I'm going to talk about first, which is, well, let's defeat the signature matching that we were depending on, that we can match patterns against the code. We can try to make the body that we decrypt also not have a signature. And this, you know, is rather than only having the decryptor have this sort of randomization, let's randomize all of the code. And what we're going to do is we're going to change everything the same sort of way we changed the decryptor. So we're going to apply this strategy of what I called a mutation engine earlier, where we're going to have... where did I put that slide? We're going to have this sort of loop where we take our code we're copying, you know, but we're not going to just do it for the decryptor. We're going to do it for all the code, and we sort of randomly vary it, and we're going to work from machine code to do this so we can actually, you know, change everything, including the code that does this changing. So, you know, there's malware which does this sort of thing. So one simple example is that you can do simple things like just change the registers. So this here is like just randomize the registers. And you can do this by, for example, having an instruction parser in your copying code that just edits the register numbers by like XORing them with something. You can still make a signature for this, but it's a lot more work, and the signature is going to be something that is a lot slower to match. And sort of the general strategy, sort of the very general approach to this, is that rather than, just sort of having sort of these fixed variations, we have this sort of very flexible transformation tool. And the way you make this very generic is by basically including a disassembler in your malware. So your malware has a disassembler, which gets instruction lengths, then it transforms instruction by instruction, does some relocation. We'll talk about what that means in a second. So on. So I'm going to go through an example of a virus called Evol, which is described in this article, which used this strategy. So when it was copying itself, it put its code through these steps. So first, it had a disassembler to get the lengths of every instruction. And you might say, well, we learned a little about x86 encoding. That seems annoying. And, well, it is, but the virus had this advantage that it knew it didn't use all the possible instructions. So, it just had a table of 61 opcodes. Yes, annoying, but not super annoying. Probably not actually a table, but probably like a bunch of if statements. And it didn't handle didn't use some features. Like, it didn't use floating points. And it only used certain types of arguments. But it had just a disassembler that identified the lengths of those instructions. And then it had this sort of transformation step. And basically, they just had a bunch of if statements. If it's this instruction, choose one of these alternatives. And they'd have these, like, these fancy alternatives, like here. So here, they would take this move instruction and translate it to a push, do something that is not actually, so we push a value that's to save a temporary register, we move EBP into a temporary register, we add something to it, and then we access using this added thing and a different offset. So this is just a fancy way of writing this move here, plus some code to set that up. So we set up ECX, is equal to EBP plus 8, plus 12, and we're accessing that at minus 10. So it ends up working out the same, but it looks very different from these sort of extra work to do this. And if we're doing this transformation every time we copy, the code is going to get bigger each time. There's like not a finite number of these variations. It just gets bigger and bigger. We're adding more and more complexity. And you imagine we might not only have a rule like this for, say, this type of move instruction, but also for push instructions and so on, where we just, add more and more confounding code. But it still has the same effect because we've just carefully written these patterns that, do the same thing, but in a more complicated way. So questions about what's happening here. So this idea that, we can translate this move into 8 plus EBP, that address, into something based on 12 plus minus something instead. Or 1, 2, sorry, plus x. So there's a question, sort of more generally, will we expect to know the level of morphicness? I would expect you to be able to look that up, turn up, and figure out which is which. I don't think it's useful to memorize. So the question is, the decryptor also transformed in the metamorphic case? So in the metamorphic case, if we're doing that if we have a decryptor, it would be transformed and the code decrypted. We also might use this without a decryptor. Another question, wouldn't the code resulting from this run much slower? Yes. Other questions? Okay, so there's an issue with doing these transformations that we need to deal with, and that's gonna is how. Where did I put this slides? Is that we're gonna mess up jumps and calls. Because if we think of, like, let's say we had a move, and then a comp, and then a JLE, well, if we translated this move into a push, and so on, and this jump, like, move jumped up to loop, well, the relative location of loop is now different, and we are going to need to deal with that. And we've just changed where, you know, especially we have, like, a move above that, we've just changed where all of these jumps and if we have calls or and other things like that go. So Evolve dealt with this. And the way it dealt with this is that it kept track of the locations in the old and new code of all the instructions. So it just had this table matching, you know, where was the old instruction, where is the new version of the instruction, so it could fix this jump to loop here and make it go to the right location in the new code when it generated a new version. It could make it go to the right place, even though that place moved because it transformed all the other code, possibly making it bigger. So the way this sort of might work is that, you know, let's say this is the code we're applying this transformation to. You know, we're going to track, oh, here's the original length, here's the length of the transformed version. And what I can do is I can say, oh, okay, this decrypt, I know where it goes in the original version. You know, I'm going to look up in the table to figure out, based on the lengths, where it goes in the new version. I'm going to find out, oh, it goes to, you know, it was originally to going to 7, which was right there in the table that tells me that transforms to 13. So questions about how this technique works. So you see what we're doing is we have the original lengths and the new lengths. So we look at, oh, this goes to address 7 after we decode the jump instruction, and we figure out, no, offset 7, I should say. We figure out what that is in the new assembly that we generated.
Does the code automatically do that for you as well, or you have to manually put in these new values for the
So the question is this done automatically? So in Evolve, this was sort of a second step after the relocation. Sorry, after the transformation. So we did the transformation, and it produced that table as it was going along, and then there was a second step of code that the malware author wrote that changed all the addresses and jump instructions and so on. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
So the question is, what's the difference between the length and the address? So so the length here, this just says how many, like I'm just saying how many bytes each of these instructions are, but the actual address depends on where we put them in memory and what the value we're going to put in the jump instruction. Well, that's for a jump instruction, it happens to be like the difference between here and here. But we could compute that from the information in this table. If we have like a instruction which it takes an absolute address, so an x86, an example would be like move from, you know, like some global that might have moved, we'd have to like look at where the new code would start in memory to figure out what to put there. So the question is, it's length in bytes from the start of the virus code. So this table is showing the length of each instruction. So the location in bytes from start is going to be 0 in the new code. It's going to be 0, then 10, then 13, then 13 plus 7, 20, and so on. I'm just adding up the numbers going down. Other questions about this relocation idea? So this idea of having this very generic mutation idea, so I should say tools for writing, is that, well, yeah, you can take one of these sort of what are called mutation engines, and they can be written so like there's no constant bytes, there's no obvious knobs, like all the instructions are useful. And sort of the strategy people use to deal with this is, well, you write a state machine-based detector. You know, the code is like, you know, has some patterns. You can actually make it work. It's apparently done manually, you know, but you know, it's something like a regular expression, but it's real annoying. And this is sort of, you know, where, you know, malware that was trying to defeat signature matching ended up. And also gives us a motivation for why we might look at like behavior-based detection. Yes, we are going to figure out ways of detecting this by looking for code patterns, but it's a lot of work. Another thing notable about this is that if you go beyond what Evol did, you can actually make this generic. You can make it work on all machine code. You just need to have something that supports all the instructions out there. And there's some malware which uses this to their advantage as an infection technique, that not only can they transform the malware code, they can use this sort of technique to transform the original executable code they're infecting, and also to like insert the virus in the middle without relying on anything like a cavity. Because they can create one because they have all this code to relocate jumps and calls. So they can just decide, I'm gonna put some code after, you know, this return here, and I'm gonna fix up all the jumps and the calls in the executable that I'm infecting, so that works. And some malware has done this, and that, you know, also defeats a bunch of the sort of looking for weird things in executable techniques we talked about earlier, where you might just say, oh, if the segment sizes are weird, that's bad. Well, you can make it look like a normal executable if you're willing to go through all this effort, which somehow some malware did. Okay. So we saw this one idea for... Okay, so before I get on. So question is, can the malware backtrack to an object file and compile their code with that object file? So you're talking about, like, when we make an executable, we take some object files, put them together to make an executable. There's not an easy generic way. Well, there isn't a way of taking an executable and converting it to an object file, which has all the information you'd expect in an object file. You could make a valid object file, but it'd be missing some things that would normally be there, which might make it harder to, you know, make an executable from that. Now, when we were looking at the generic detection strategy, we looked at some ideas of, well, instead of trying to make it so we don't have a signature, which is what we just talked about, other strategies might be, you know, just make things not work because we have to do our detection in something like a VM, or an emulator. And this is because of that idea of this is how we'll handle that packing strategy, and also because people who research malware are going to try to run it in a VM or an emulator. So it would be great if your malware looks different there, So it's more annoying to analyze and like write signatures for if that's being done by hand. So there's a whole bunch of things that malware commonly does to do this. I mean, you alluded to one, which is timing things. Probably the simplest, but also one of the easier ones to deal with, is querying devices. That if we're running in a VM, we don't have a typical disk, we don't have a typical keyboard, so you can look for things that are classical VM or emulator devices. And most virtualization software you'd use, like, casually, doesn't try to hide this stuff. It's configured to have, you know, special device drivers because it's faster. You know, it puts its brand name on the Ethernet device. If you ask what type of Ethernet card do I have, or, you know, what type of Wi-Fi card do I have, it's a VMware or VirtualBox branded one. And, well, that's pretty easy to detect. The solution's relatively simple. Just configure our virtual machine or emulator to have devices that match some real hardware that the malware author wants to work on. So for timing operations, you know, that's the idea that, well, if we're in a VM or an emulator, some things are going to be slower. And some things are going to be way, way slower. You know, especially things that whoever's trying to detect that were malware is looking for, like, say, writing executables. Like, that's going to be way slower if they're doing scanning as part of that. So you can do operations which you think are going to be slow and try to support that, try to detect that. And the solution, someone mentioned earlier, is just have a virtual clock, pretend that time passes slower, and hope that you can hope that they won't catch on that that's not a real clock. So another thing that malware might commonly do is you look for things that an emulator or a virtual machine doesn't support. So for example, let's say you're writing your anti-malware software and you have an emulator, and well, you didn't bother to implement all the floating point instructions, or all the vector instructions, or you didn't look up the instructions that Intel forgot to document. Well, the malware can take advantage of the fact that, well, those exist on a real hardware and figure out that they're in a virtual machine. Or let's say I can ask the OS to do things like, say, set up a handler for one of my program segfaults that you don't handle in your virtual emulator. Well, I can, you know, ask to do that, and when that doesn't work, I say, okay, you're not running me for real. I'm not going to do something that will cause you to detect this as malicious. And sort of the sort of necessary outcome of this is that if you're writing an emulator or a virtual machine for this, you need to start supporting all these extra operations. Or if you're like doing this by hand, you need to, like, when you figure out the malware is doing this, edit that code that uses those operations. So it's a question I mentioned: undocumented CPU instructions. How would the malware author know about this? So this is not, this is undocumented by, you know, Intel, AMD, VIA, etc., but not unknown. Like, people have figured out things that, you know, at some point weren't officially documented, but people figured out what does the processor actually do and took advantage of those. So we also alluded to sort of a more generic way of attacking emulators, which is emulators are slower and there's sort of a lack of patience, right? That if I'm writing an email scanner, I'm not going to run sort of a piece of potential malware in an emulator for 10 minutes. But if it's a, you know, a PDF or something, maybe the user would open it for 10 minutes. So another sort of malware solution is that you can just take too long to do anything malicious. And related to that, you can just not always do something malicious. You might say, well, how does that work? Well, you can, like, have your code be, you know, choose a random number, and if it's 4, I'm going to do something bad, but if it's not 4, I'm not, and, you know, most of the time, you're not going to do something bad. And if you think the user is going to run you a lot of times, this is perfectly fine, maybe even if not, because, you know, most of the time, you won't be detected this way. Sort of another related strategy is that you can use a lot of other resources that this sort of the anti-malware scanner or the analyst might not want to give you. Like, you can allocate several gigs of memory, which on a typical machine would work, but maybe the email scanning software isn't willing to keep emulating this piece of software if it uses 2 gigs of RAM. So you could use that as a way of detecting this virtual machine or emulation and not doing something malicious in it. So questions on these anti-virtualization ideas? Okay, so we mentioned this idea of, of worrying about malware running in these emulators or virtual machines, primarily to deal with packing techniques, though you could also imagine it might be used to look for suspicious, like, patterns of file accesses. So a thing related to that is that a lot of anti-malware software tries to have files that are set up for self-replicating malware as sort of traps that, well, like, if I have an executable that no one ever runs, it should never get changed. So they'll set up what Zur called a goat file as a sacrificial goat to be changed by the malware. And when malware authors noticed that this was happening, well, they just set up heuristics to identify files that probably were that sort of thing. Like, they just said, oh, if there's a really small executable that's not infected, it might be a trap. And, you know, things like that. If it has lots of NOPs, let's not infect it because it's probably just part of some anti-malware software. So that's sort of another thing. And this is on the same vein as this anti-virtualization technique, that you're doing things to kind of detect and avoid those situations where you're running in a scenario where that anti-malware software may notice. And I think I don't have enough time to go through. I'll introduce our sort of one of our last pieces of this idea of things that people analyzing malware want to do, and that's, you know, often they want to run it in debuggers. And a bunch of malware tries specifically to make them not work in debuggers. And we're going to look at that as our first topic next time. And there's 2 pieces of functionality we're going to care about. So one is breakpoints in debuggers, that if you're trying to figure out what malware does, you're going to try to, like, set a breakpoint. Another is single stepping, that the debugger lets you step instruction by instruction. And the way these are implemented often lets malware kind of detect that this is happening. And there's some malware which deliberately tries to do it and behave differently if you, say, set a breakpoint in it or try single-stepping over it. And sort of our preview before we pick up next time is that this sort of kind of the simplest way to implement breakpoints, but not the only one else we'll discuss, is for the debugger to, you know, the debugger does this edit of adding a jump or something like a jump in the middle of your code. And we'll talk about what form that takes next time and what malware does knowing this next time. Okay, so that's where I'm going to stop for today. I'll take questions before I sign off.